Hello, and welcome to Tech Talk. Your reader for Tech Talk today will be William Hinkle. Articles will come from the New York Times Technology section.
In your first article, a focus on Google. Google says a change in its algorithm will highlight original reporting. After weeks of reporting, a journalist breaks the story. Moments after it goes online, another media organization posts an imitative article recycling the scoop that often grabs as much web traffic as the original. Publishers have complained about this dynamic for years, ever since the explosion in digital news obliterated the day-long exclusive enjoyed in the print era. On Thursday, Google said that it had made changes to its search algorithm to give an advantage to original reporting that would be reinforced by changes in other guidelines. In a blog post, Richard Gingras, Google's vice president of news, said the changes to the company's search guidelines would help it to better recognize original reporting and make it more visible on the internet. This means readers interested in the latest news can find the story that started it all, Mr. Gingras wrote, and publishers can benefit from having their original reporting more widely seen. In a phone interview on Thursday, Mr. Gingras acknowledged that the shift was in Google's own interest. We do everything here with Google Search and Google News to continue to earn and retain the trust of our users, he said. Google and other major tech platforms have lately come under scrutiny and federal antitrust investigations, in part because of their influence over the digital news industry. Google, Facebook, and Amazon reap most of the available online advertising revenue. The News Media Alliance, a trade group, has been sharply critical of the tech companies and has lobbied lawmakers for a limited antitrust exemption that would enable outlets to bargain collectively with the platforms. In turn, several platforms have signaled a willingness to work with publishers. Facebook has pitched an initiative to license articles from major publishers and display them in a news tab. The Apple News app has made deals with some media companies, including Condé Nast, to highlight their articles and split revenue. David Chivern, the News Media Alliance chief executive, welcomed Google's announcement but cautioned that he had to wait to see how the changes were carried out. Google search results have not rewarded investments in journalism, Mr. Chivern said in a phone interview Thursday. If we can get to a place where they do better, that's good. Google seemed to acknowledge with Thursday's changes that publications that dig up new information could use some help from the platforms. Some stories can also be both critically important in the impact they can have on our world and difficult to put together, requiring reporters to engage in deep investigative efforts to dig up facts and sources, Mr. Gingras said in the post. These are among the reasons why we aim to support these industry efforts. The guidelines from Google would also elevate outlets known for a history of accurate reporting, considering metrics like how many journalism awards a publication has won. Several tech platforms, including the Google-owned YouTube, have been criticized for seeming to promote sensational content with no basis in fact. Soon after the 2018 massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, for instance, the number one trending video on YouTube tapped into false theories that the survivors of the shooting were crisis actors. That kind of inflammatory content may attract views in the short run while damaging the reputation of any company that makes it widely available. The three examples of hard news articles Mr. Gingras noted in his post were published by large outlets. The Süddeutsche Zeitung in Munich, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. It was unclear what the algorithm change would mean for publications in small and mid-sized cities that have struggled in recent years while trying to transition from print to digital. Google, Mr. Gingras said, is putting increased effort into how do we do right by local outlets. He cited reporting on natural disasters as a type of local coverage that could benefit from the changes. And now, secure your digital life in 7 easy days. Stop dragging your feet and take control of your online security. We'll make it easy. And now, transformative. new device harvests energy in darkness. It doesn't generate much power, but it works during the one time of day that solar cells can't, night. Aswath Rahman was driving through a village in Sierra Leone in 2013 when an idea came to him as suddenly as, perhaps, a light bulb switching on. The village was not equipped with electricity, and Dr. Rahman, an electrical engineer at the University of California, Los Angeles, was unaware he was in a village until he heard the voices of shadowed human figures. It took us about 5 minutes to realize we were passing through a town because it was completely dark, Dr. Rahman said. There wasn't a single light on. Dr. Rahman wondered whether he could use all that darkness to make something to light it up, not unlike the way that solar panels generate electricity from the sun's heat and light. He did. In new research published on Thursday in the journal Jewel, Dr. Rahman demonstrates a way to harness the dark night sky to power a light bulb. His prototype device employs radiative cooling, the phenomenon that makes buildings and parks feel cooler than the surrounding air after sunset. As Dr. Rahman's device releases heat, it does so unevenly, the top side cooling more than the bottom. It then converts the difference in heat into electricity. In the paper, Dr. Rahman described how the device, when connected to a voltage converter, was able to power a white LED. The core enabling feature of this device is that it can cool down, Dr. Rahman said. Jeffrey C. Grossman, a materials scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology who studies passive cooling and solar technology, said the work was quite exciting and showed promise for the development of low-power applications at night. They have suggested reasonable paths for increasing the performance of their device, Dr. Grossman said. But there is definitely a long way to go if they want to use it as an alternative to adding battery storage for solar cells. Everything emits heat, according to the laws of thermodynamics. At night, when one side of Earth turns away from the sun, its buildings, streets, and jacketless people cool off. If no clouds are present to trap warmth, objects on the Earth can lose so much heat that they reach a lower temperature than the air surrounding them. This is why blades of grass may be glazed in frost on clear fall mornings, even when the air temperature is above freezing. The cloudless atmosphere becomes a porthole to the void, through which warmth flows like air through a porch screen. Humans have taken advantage of this effect for millenniums. 6,000 years ago, people in what are now Iran and Afghanistan constructed enormous beehive-shaped structures called yakchal, which used this passive cooling effect to create and store ice in the desert. Modern scientists have studied how to harness energy from Earth's day-night swings in temperature, but that work has mostly remained theoretical. In 2014, researchers led by Federico Capasso, an electrical engineering professor at Harvard, calculated that at best only about 4 watts of energy can be extracted from a square meter of cold space. By contrast, a photovoltaic panel, the most common type of solar panel, generates about 200 watts per square meter in direct sunlight. Nonetheless, a device that could produce any amount of electricity at night would be valuable. After the sun sets, solar cells don't work and winds often die down, even as demand for lighting peaks. Shenghui Fan, an electrical engineer at Stanford and an author on Dr. Rahman's study, has been at the vanguard of this research. Last fall, Dr. Fan's team described a device that can generate electricity with solar panels during the day, then used a passive cooling effect to chill a building at night. Earlier this year, they also tested an infrared photodiode, similar to the technology used in most solar cells, but which uses warmth, not sunlight, to generate wisps of electricity in the darkness. The prototype, built by Dr. Rahman, resembles a hockey puck set inside a chafing dish. The puck is a polyesterine disc coated in black paint and covered with a windshield. At its heart is an off-the-shelf gadget called a thermoelectric generator, which uses the difference in temperature between opposite sides of the device to generate a current. A similar device powers NASA's Curiosity rover on Mars, Its thermoelectric generator derives heat from plutonium radiation. Usually, the temperature difference in these generators is stark, and they are carefully engineered to separate hot and cold. Dr. Rahman's device instead uses the atmosphere's ambient temperature as a heat source. The shift from warm to cool is very slight, meaning the device can't produce much power. His puck in a dish is elevated on aluminum legs, enabling air to flow around it. As the dark puck loses warmth to the night sky, the side facing the stars grows colder than the side facing the air-warmed tabletop. This slight difference in temperature generates a flow of electricity. When paired with a voltage converter, the prototype produced 25 milliwatts of power per square meter. That is about 3 orders of magnitude lower than what a typical solar panel produces, and well short of even the roughly 4-watt maximum efficiency for such devices. Still, several experts said the prototype was an important contribution to a new and relatively unusual space in the renewable energy sector. This is a neat combination of radiative cooling, a technique where Rahman has pioneered real working devices, with thermoelectric materials that generate electricity if one side is hotter than the other side, said Ellen D. Williams, a physics professor at the University of Maryland and a former director of the Department of Energy's Advanced Research Projects Agency, Energy. Both technologies are proven and practical, but I haven't seen them combined like this. They did this with inexpensive materials, suggesting it could be made into useful products for the developing world. One challenge will be improving the device's efficiency without raising its costs, says Lance Wheeler, a materials scientist at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado. Although thermoelectric devices are less efficient and more expensive than photovoltaic cells, they can be more durable. You could call this a long play, he said. It is just a piece of metal with spray paint on it. It could last for a super long time, and its rivals, photovoltaic cells and batteries, don't. It can enhance any thermoelectric device as long as it's outside facing the stars. Conceivably, Dr. Rahman said, thermoelectric devices could complement solar-powered lights in areas where changing batteries is a challenge, like on street lamps or in remote areas far from electrical grids. I figured the amount of electricity we would get would be pretty small, and it was, he said. But walking around in Sierra Leone, I realized lighting remains a big problem, so it's an opportunity as well.
Now in article number 3. Apple TV Plus is just $5. Will people pay for it? Tim Cook went into full salesman mode at Apple's promotional event on Tuesday as he revealed the price for a monthly subscription for its streaming service, Apple TV Plus. All of these incredible shows for the price of a single movie rental, Mr. Cook, Apple's chief executive said. This is crazy. Apple TV Plus is scheduled to make its debut as a competitor to Netflix and Amazon on November 1st. The cost is $5 a month. For anyone buying a new iPhone, iPad, or Mac laptop, a one-year subscription will be thrown in free. In the streaming industry, $5 is a figure that grabs attention. Disney announced $7 as the monthly price for its original service, Disney Plus, which has a November 12th start date. An Amazon Prime subscription, which includes streaming, is a $10 a month, while Hulu goes for $6 a month with ads and $12 without. CBS All Access costs $6 with commercials and $10 without. Warner Media's noon streaming service, HBO Max, is scheduled to go live next year at no lower than $15 a month, and Netflix's standard plan costs $13 a month. Why is Apple the cheapest of the bunch? One reason is that it will offer much less content than its competitors. While Netflix has a vast library of material from other studios and seems to unveil a series, special, or rom-com every other day, Apple TV Plus will offer roughly a dozen shows in its first wave of programming over the next year. Disney Plus will be packed to the last pixel with a library of original movies, Star Wars films, blockbusters from Marvel Entertainment and Pixar, as well as The Simpsons, and the many other properties it picked up in its $71 billion purchase of much of the 21st Century Fox entertainment empire. HBO Max will draw on its vast Warner Brothers film archive, which includes Wonder Woman and the Harry Potter series, not to mention decades of HBO programming and Friends. Apple TV Plus hopes to attract subscribers with a simple sales pitch. By claiming that it shows and that its shows and movies will be of higher quality than what they'll find elsewhere. As Mr. Cook described it as he paced the stage, Apple TV Plus will have the best movies, comedies, dramas, and kid shows. In effect, Apple is hoping customers will part with a $5 a month for the same reason they pay for premium cable channels like HBO or Showtime. But that pet pitch was easier to make in the days before streaming, when there was a stark difference between what viewers could find on basic cable channels and the broadcast networks. Now there are more shows and a greater variety of shows than ever before. To prepare for the November 1st debut, the company created an entertainment arm from scratch, installing the Hollywood veterans Jamie Ehrlich and Zach Van Amburg as top executives. The division has spent well over $1 billion to develop more than a dozen shows, cutting checks to Oprah Winfrey, Steven Spielberg, Reese Witherspoon, and J.J. Abrams. One of Apple TV's Plus marquee programs, The Morning Show, a drama set in the world of morning television, stars Ms. Witherspoon, Jennifer Aniston, and Steve Carell. C, a fantasy, features Jason Momoa and Alfred Woodard. There is also Dickinson, a quirky comedy with Haley Steinfeld and Jane Krakowski in lead roles that puts a contemporary spin on the poet Emily Dickinson. Children's programming includes a Peanuts series. Apple said it planned to roll out new shows each month, including a thriller from the director of M. Night Shyamalan and a series starring Octavia Spencer. In the not-too-distant future, it will have a slate big enough to rival networks that have been in business for decades. The first hurdle will be the reaction of critics and social media users. Then comes awards season. Apple's first shows will be eligible for the 2020 Golden Globe Awards. Nominees will be announced December 9th. If Apple is able to storm the Golden Globe stage at the Beverly Hilton on January 5th, any remaining Hollywood skeptics will have no choice but to consider the tech upstart a major player in entertainment. Article number 4. Wondering who did that painting? There's an app or two for that. With companies racing to develop Shazam for art, we see what instant identification apps really add to your experience in museums and galleries. At the Betty Cunningham Gallery on the Lower East Side recently, I noticed an arresting painting. It showed a nude woman curled against a window asleep, with the old New Yorker Hotel and Empire State Building in view, and a fish above her hanging or floating. I opened a smartphone app called Magnus, snapped a quick picture, and clicked Use. Seconds later, I got that addictive, satisfying click. The app had found a match. The painting was by Philip Perlstein, according to the app, known for reinvigorating the tradition of realist figure painting. It was titled Model with Empire State Building. Dated 1992, measured 72 inches by 60 inches, and was for sale for $300,000. In 2010, it had sold for $170,500 at Sotheby's in New York, the app told me. Magnus then slotted this information into a folder marked My Art for digital safekeeping and future looking. Magnus is part of a wave of smartphone apps trying to catalog the physical world as a way of providing instantaneous information about songs or clothes or plants or paintings. First came Shazam, an app that allows users to record a few seconds of a song and instantly identifies it. Shazam's wild success, it boasts more than 1 billion downloads and 20 million users daily, and was purchased by Apple for a reported $400 million last year, has spawned endless imitations. There is Shazam for plants, or Shazam for clothes, and now Shazam for art. The art-oriented apps harness image recognition technology, each with a particular twist. Magnus has built a database of more than 10 million images of art, mostly crowdsourced, and aims to help prospective art buyers navigate the notoriously information-light arena of galleries and fairs. Other apps are geared towards museum goers. Smartify, for example, takes an educational approach, teaming up with museums and sometimes galleries to upload digitized versions of their collections, wall texts, and information about artists. Google Lens, Google's advanced image recognition technology, is making new forays into the art world. In June, Google Lens announced a partnership with the De Young Museum in San Francisco to show parts of the museum's collection. In July, Google began collaborating with Westcover, a platform oriented toward design objects, public and local art, furniture, and craft, enabling you to learn the name of that anonymous painting in your WeWork space or coffee shop. There are some barriers, particularly to creating a Shazam for art. Magnus Resch, founder of the Magnus app, laid out one. There's a lot more art in the world than there are songs. Cataloging individual artworks based in unique locations is far more difficult. Copyright law also poses challenges. The reproduction of artwork can be a violation of the owner's copyright. Magnus contends that because the images are created and shared by users, the app is protected by the Digital Millennial Copyright Act. Galleries and competitors, Mr. Resch said, complained about the uploading of images and data to the app. In 2016, it was removed from the Apple Store for 5 months, but Apple ultimately reinstated Magnus after some disputed content was removed. Another issue is that image recognition technology still often lags when it comes to identifying 3D objects. Even a well-known sculptor can baffle apps with its angles, resulting in the deflating, endless spin of technology that's thinking ad infinitum. Then there is a more salient question for these platforms. What information can an app provide that will enhance the user's experience of looking at art? What can a Shazam for art really add? Mr. Resch's answer is simple. Transparency. Galleries rarely post prices and often don't provide basic wall texts, so one often has to ask for the title or even the artist's name. Jelena Cohen, a brand manager for Colgate-Palmolive, bought her first artwork, a photograph, at Freeze after using Magnus. Before trying the app, she said, the lack of information was a barrier. I used to go to these art fairs and I felt embarrassed or shy because nothing's listed, Ms. Cohen said. I loved that the app could scan a piece and give you the exact history of it, when it was last sold, and the price it was sold for. That helped me negotiate. Magnus doesn't give you an art history lesson or even much of a basic summary about a work. Like Shazam, it's a little blip of information in the dark. Smartify, on the other hand, wants to appify what was once the purview of an audio guide. Hold it up to a Gustav Kelbo still life, as I did, and the app provides information that's already available on the wall, including the chance to click to learn more. Part of the app's mission is the ease of use and accessibility. People with visual impairments can use Smartify with their phone's native audio settings, and the app is working to integrate audio. The app is elegant and straightforward, and the source is generally cited and fact-checked. Smartify's major limitation is that because the app teams up directly with museums, it only works well in a few places. London's National Gallery, where I tested it, was one of them. It didn't miss a single painting in the permanent collection, but at the Met, where Smartify has uploaded a limited set of images, I spent a frustrating afternoon waving the app at paintings as it failed to return even facts that I could read in the wall texts. It's telling, perhaps, that even as these apps build out their databases, some museums themselves are starting to shy away from apps altogether. The Metropolitan Museum, which rolled out its own app with fanfare in 2014, shuttered it last year. While the app was doing a lot of things well, we wanted to create something more seamless, said Sophie Anderson, the interim chief digital officer at the Met. This translates into content that loads directly in your phone browser as a website. No download required. Similarly, the Jewish Museum introduced a new set of audio tours in July, all on a web-based interface. A few years ago, there was an app craze, and now everyone's entering this post-app phase in the museum industry, said Gigi Fay, director of the digital for the Jewish Museum. She noted that the vast majority of apps that people download sit unused on their phones. You just end up using your email and Instagram. After a few weeks of trying out apps for art in museums and galleries, on street corners, and in the occasional coffee shop, I found that they did not increase the quality of my visual encounters. Although the caliber of information in Smartify is quite high when it works, I was able to learn more about specific figures in J.M.W. Turner's Ulysses deriding Polyphemus. The simple act of raising my phone to take a picture transformed a vibrant physical painting into a flattened reproduction. The extra information wasn't worth mediating my museum experience through a screen. And phones are already everywhere in museums, transforming a visit into cataloging as we go. Ms. Fay referred to this as "stream suck," and it's one reason audio is the preferred medium for the Jewish Museum. Like Shazam itself, the apps are best used for a quick answer and a lifetime in a contextless gallery. What is that? How much does it cost? Who made it? Well, here, Magnus is the leader. The Shazamification of art is a product of a time in which information overpowers the naked eye. But the app shouldn't be our sole guide through the visual world. Walking around the New York Museum with the Magnus app, I found myself breezing past paintings, not looking too hard at details because the camera was looking for me, and the app knew much more than I did. There was that little addictive, satisfying click of recognition. It was hard to stop. And for our final article today, how Apple's apps topped rivals in the App Store it controls. Top spots in App Store research or search results are some of the most fought over real estate in the online economy. The store generated more than $50 billion in sales last year, and the company said two-thirds of app downloads started with a search. But as Apple has become one of the largest competitors on a platform that it controls, suspicions that the company has been tipping the scales in its own favor are at the heart of antitrust complaints in the United States, Europe, and Russia. Apple's apps have ranked first recently for at least 700 search terms in the store, according to a New York Times analysis of 6 years of search results compiled by Sensor Tower, an app analytics firm. Some searches produce as many as 14 Apple apps before showing results from rivals, the analysis showed, though competitors could pay Apple to place ads above the Apple results. So that's it for Tech Talk this week. Please join me again next week for the latest from the technology sector.